Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Anne Ball. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, North Korea launched two short-distance projectiles Tuesday, a few hours after offering to restart talks with the United States this month. It is the 10th set of weapons tests since May. That is when North Korea restarted missile tests after more than 1 year without one. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the projectiles were launched from South Pyongan province in the country's western area and landed in the sea off of North Korea's eastern coast. American and South Korean officials said the projectiles traveled about 330 kilometers. The South Korean military called for the North to immediately stop actions that increase tensions on the Korean Peninsula. U.S. officials said they knew about the activity and were working closely with allies. The test comes hours after North Korean Vice Foreign Minister Choi Sun-hee said that North Korea was willing to restart talks with the U.S. this month. "We are willing to sit face-to-face with the U.S. around late September at a time and place that we can agree on," Choi said. Her statement was carried by the official North Korean Central News Agency. However, Choi said that the U.S. must produce an acceptable calculation or risk the end of talks. North Korea has been seeking some compromise from the U.S. in easing economic sanctions. Reporters later asked U.S. President Donald Trump about the offer to meet for talks. He said, "I always say having meetings is a good thing, not a bad thing." Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un held their second set of talks in Hanoi, Vietnam, in February, but did not reach a deal. Trump rejected Kim's demand for relief from some U.S. economic sanctions in return for moves to partly end North Korea's nuclear weapons program. The two leaders did meet for a short time in June at the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea. However, working-level talks have not yet started.
Doctors have released a study timed to the anniversary of the September 11, 2001 attacks against the United States. On that day, militants seized four passenger airplanes and flew them into U.S. targets. Nearly 3,000 people were killed in what Americans now call the 9/11 attacks. Two of the airplanes hit the World Trade Center buildings in New York City. The strikes led to their collapse and fires that burned for days. huge clouds of dust were released into the air. The new study tells about firefighters who arrived early or spent a lot of time at the World Trade Center site after the 9/11 attacks. It found they seemed to have a somewhat higher risk of developing heart problems than firefighters who arrived later or stayed less. The study might influence any effort to expand the list of health problems eligible for payment to victims of the attacks. The money comes from a program set up by the U.S. Congress after the disaster. The Associated Press noted limitations of the study. Researchers said they cannot prove that dust or anything else from the disaster caused increased heart risk. The study also does not compare the New York firefighters to the general population or to other emergency workers or construction industry workers. However, the study does suggest that working at the World Trade Center site raised the risk for some firefighters more than others. It found that those who arrived by noon that day had a 44% greater chance of suffering heart problems compared to those who arrived hours or days later. In addition, the risk of heart problems increased by 33% for those who worked in the area for 6 or more months. However, the increased risk was evident in a fairly small number of cases. The study found that only about 5% of the firefighters studied had cardiovascular disease. David Prezant is chief medical officer of the fire department of the city of New York. He said, "This is a modest increase, not an epidemic." But he added, "This risk increases over time. It doesn't disappear." The study followed the health of 9,796 male firefighters for 16 years after the disaster. Female firefighters were not included because there were only 25, and their health risk was likely different from the men, the study said. Researchers examined medical records of the male firefighters before the attacks. They identified 489 heart problems since September 11, 2001. That number included 120 heart attacks and 300 treatments for blocked arteries. The study found that heart-related risks were higher for the 1,600 firefighters who arrived at the Trade Center by noon. The researchers noted there are good records of when the firefighters arrived, but there is less information about how long each worked in the area of the disaster. Judith Graber is a researcher at the Rutgers School of Public Health in New Jersey. She has studied other workers involved in the 9/11 effort. She praised the study, saying the important thing is the additional evidence suggesting increased risk. Prezant said other studies have suggested a greater risk of heart problems among 9/11 workers. He noted such problems are not covered under the program that treats emergency workers or the Victim Compensation Fund. U.S. lawmakers set up the fund to help individuals who suffered physical harm and family members of those killed in the attacks. More than 51,000 people have asked for money from the fund. The Associated Press reported that $5.5 billion has already been paid out. On July 29th, lawmakers passed a bill that provides money for the fund until the year 2092. The results of the study on firefighters were published in JAMA Network Open. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Some famous universities are dealing with reports about their financial ties to businessman and convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, has ordered an independent investigation into financing of MIT's Media Lab. The order comes after the head of the laboratory resigned over its ties to Epstein. Separately, other universities that accepted his money say they have no plans to return the donations. The issue of questionable donations has sent shockwaves through the world of education. It shows the problems educators face as they decide whether to accept money from people accused of wrongdoing. Jeffrey Epstein was a wealth manager who was seen with the rich, famous, and powerful people. He owned a private island in the Caribbean, homes in Paris and New York City, and a New Mexico farm. Epstein was arrested in July on federal sex trafficking charges. His arrest brought new attention to old claims that he had sexually abused women and girls. He killed himself in jail last month while awaiting his trial. For 3 years, Joy Ito served as director of the MIT Media Lab. He resigned from both the lab and from his position as a professor, the school's president announced on Saturday. The resignation came a day after The New Yorker reported that the Media Lab had a bigger fundraising relationship with Epstein than it had admitted earlier. The magazine also said the Media Lab tried to cover up the nature of the relationship. In Rhode Island, Brown University announced on Monday that it has placed Peter Cohen, a fundraising director, on leave. This followed a report that Cohen helped cover up Epstein's connections when he was working at the MIT lab. A Brown spokesman also said the university did not receive donations from Jeffrey Epstein. MIT was not the only school to receive money from the businessman over the years. He donated tens of millions of dollars to Harvard University and other causes. It made him popular with some professors and scientists. Yet he himself
never finished college. Harvard says it already spent $6.5 million that Epstein donated in 2003. That was before he admitted in court to soliciting a minor for prostitution. The University of Arizona and the University of British Columbia in Canada have said they are not returning the tens of thousands of dollars they received years ago. They said the money came from charitable groups Epstein operated, and they did not know the connection to him at the time. Ohio State University has not said what will come of the money it received from Epstein, including the $2.5 million he donated in 2007. In a letter on Saturday, MIT President Raphael Reif called the claims in the New Yorker deeply disturbing. He said the university is asking lawyers to investigate. Last month, Reif reported that MIT accepted about $800,000 from Epstein over 20 years. I'm Ann Ball.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
On July 4, 1776, the Second Continental Congress, meeting in Philadelphia, approved the Declaration of Independence. The new country, the United States of America, was at war with its former colonial ruler, Britain. Yet, not everyone in the former colonies agreed with the decision to declare independence. No one knows for sure how many Americans remained loyal to Great Britain. John Adams, the Massachusetts political leader, thought that about a third of the colonists supported independence, a third supported Britain, and a third supported neither side. Today, many historians think that only about 20% of the colonists supported Britain. Some colonists supported whichever side seemed to be winning. As many as 30,000 Americans fought for the British during the war. Others helped Britain by reporting the movements of American troops. Who supported Britain? These groups included people who were appointed to their jobs by the king. They also included leaders of the Anglican Church and people with business connections to the British. Professor Gordon Wood at Brown University in Rhode Island says many colonists from minority groups remained loyal to the king.
One of the problems of the American Revolution that emerged very quickly was the tyranny of the majority, which the founders, the revolutionary leaders, had not anticipated. But I think we're seeing the problems that emerge when you overthrow an authoritarian leader and you're going to have a relatively democratic society, then protecting the minority becomes a problem.
Other people remained loyal because they did not want change or because they believed that independence would not improve their lives. Some thought the actions of the British government were not bad enough to bring about a rebellion. Others did not believe that the rebels could win a war against a nation as powerful as Britain. American Indians disagreed among themselves about the revolution. Congress knew it had to make peace with the Indians as soon as the war started. If not, American troops might have to fight them and the British at the same time. To prevent trouble, American officials tried to stop settlers from moving into Indian lands. In some places, the Indians joined the Americans, but generally they supported the British. They expected the British to win. They saw the war as a chance to force the Americans to leave their lands. At times, the Indians fought on the side of the British, but left when the British seemed to be losing the battle. The Americans did not forget that the Indians chose to fight for the British. When the war was over, the Americans felt they owed the Indians nothing. African slaves in the colonies were also divided about which side to join during the American Revolution. Thousands of slaves fought for the British. The British offered them freedom if they served in the army or navy. Some American states also offered to free slaves who served, and hundreds of free blacks fought on the American side. Many slaves, however, felt their chances for freedom were better with the British. At least 5,000 blacks served with the colonial American forces. Most had no choice. They were slaves, and their owners took them to war or sent them instead of the owner's sons. Other slaves felt that a nation built on freedom might share some of that freedom with them. In the South, many slave owners kept their slaves at home rather than send them to fight. Later in the war, when every man was needed, many slaves drove wagons and carried supplies. Those who served in the colonial army and navy were not separated from whites. They fought side by side with whites during the American Revolution. But historians say most slaves spent the war as they always had, working on their owners' farms. The American rebels called themselves patriots. Those who supported the British were known as Tories. Patriots often seized the property of Tories to help pay for the war. They also kidnapped the slaves of Tories to use as laborers for the army. Many Tories were forced from towns in which they had lived all their lives. Some were tortured or hanged. In New Jersey, Tories and patriots fought one another with guns and sometimes burned each other's houses and farms. Some historians say the American Revolution was really the nation's first civil war. The Revolution divided many families. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society tells of a woman named Phoebe. Phoebe was married to a patriot, but her brother was a Tory.
And we think about what it must have been like for Phoebe in the middle between her husband and her brother. So that's a perfect example of a family that was split.
The patriots were also split among themselves in their thinking. The colonies did not really think of themselves as one nation. They saw themselves as independent states trying to work together toward a common goal. Historian Gordon Wood says, at first, the United States was more like the European Union is today.
Jefferson said, "My country," he meant Virginia. John Adams said, "My country," he meant Massachusetts.
This meant that Congress could not order the states to do anything they did not want to do. Congress could not demand that the states provide money for the war. It could only ask for their help. George Washington, the top general, could not draft men into the army. He could only wait for the states to send them. Washington showed that he was a good politician by the way he kept Congress and the 13 states supporting him throughout the war. Just as Americans did not all agree about the war, the British people did not agree about it either. Many supported the government's decision to fight. They believed that the war was necessary to rescue loyalists from the Patriots. Others did not think Britain should fight the Americans because the Americans had not invaded or threatened their country. They believed that Britain should leave the colonies alone to do as they wished. King George was not able to do this, however. He supported the war as a way to continue his power in the world and to rescue British honor in the eyes of other national leaders. Whichever side British citizens were on, there was no question that the war was causing severe problems in Britain. British businessmen could no longer trade with the American colonies. Prices increased, taxes did too, and young men were forced to serve in the Royal Navy. At the start of the war, the British believed that the rebellion was led by a few extremists in New England. They thought the other colonies would surrender if that area could be surrounded and controlled. So they planned to separate New England from the other colonies by taking control of the Hudson River Valley. The British changed their plans after they were defeated in the Battle of Saratoga in New York State. Historian Gordon Wood says the British loss changed the nature of the war.
The French feel at this point that the Americans might make it, and therefore they throw in their support. Once the French come on board, then the British are really panicked. At that point, they offer the Americans everything the Americans had wanted, save independence. But it was too late.
The British experienced many problems fighting the war. Their troops were far from home across a wide ocean. It was difficult to bring in more troops and supplies. Gordon Wood says the distance across the Atlantic was one reason the British lost the war.
Even though they were the most powerful nation in the world, had a superb army, and of course completely controlled the seas, and they were dealing with the ragtag army of George Washington and a bunch of militia, and they couldn't do it.
General Washington's army had its own problems, too. Congress never had enough money. States often did not do what they were supposed to do. And citizens were not always willing to fight. Soldiers were poorly trained and would promise to serve for only a year or so.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.